Chapter 6, Returning the Boon, 2011 to 2015. It seems to me that life consists of three phases. In the first, we are dependent on others and we learn. In the second, others are dependent on us and we work. And in the third and last, others no longer depend on us and we no longer have to work. We are free to savor life. I was beginning to transition from my second to my third phase. Both intellectually and emotionally, I was no longer as excited about being successful as I was excited about having the people I cared about be successful without me. I had two jobs at Bridgewater to transition out of: overseeing the management of the company as chief executive officer, and overseeing the management of our investments as chief investment officer. I wasn't going to stop playing the markets because that's a game I've loved playing since I was 12 and I will keep playing until I die. But I didn't want to be needed in either role because of the key man risk that would create for the company. My partners and I understood that transitioning from the first generation of leadership to the next in a founder-led organization with a unique culture is difficult, especially if the leader has been in place a long time. Bill Gates's transition out of the CEO role at Microsoft in 2008 was the most recent example of that, but there have been many others. The biggest question I wrestled with was whether I should leave management completely or stay involved as a mentor. On the one hand, I liked the idea of stepping out completely because it would give the new leadership the freedom to find their own way of succeeding without me looking over their shoulder. My friends urged me to do that, to declare victory, collect my chips, and move on. But I wasn't confident the transition would go well, as I hadn't done such a thing before. I do things through trial and error, making mistakes, figuring out what I did wrong, coming up with new principles, and finally succeeding, and I didn't see why my transition should be any different. I also didn't believe that it would be fair for me to dump the heavy workload I was carrying onto those who I was passing my CEO responsibilities to. I knew that Lee Kuan Yew, the wise founder and leader of Singapore for 41 years, had transitioned out of his leadership responsibilities to be a mentor, and I had seen how well that went. For all those reasons, I decided that I would stay as a mentor. That meant I would either not speak at all or speak last, but always be available to provide advice. My partners liked the idea. We agreed that we should begin as soon as possible so that those replacing me could gain experience and we could make adjustments as needed. Since what we didn't know about transitioning was greater than what we did know about it, we knew that we would need to be careful. We expected that transitioning well would take a number of years, perhaps 2 or 3, or perhaps as many as 10. Since we had worked together for many years, we were optimistic that it would be on the shorter end of that range. On the first day of 2011, I announced to the company that I would be stepping down as CEO, with Greg Jensen and David McCormick replacing me. On July 1st, I handed over my management responsibilities to Greg, David, and the rest of the management committee. Simultaneously, we explained our up to 10-year transition plan to our clients. Learning what shapers are like. Naturally, the new management team struggled over the next 18 months or so. We diagnosed why in the same way an engineer would diagnose why a machine is operating suboptimally so it could be re-engineered to perform better. Since different people produce different outcomes based on differences in what they're like, whenever we create a team, we seek to engineer the right mix of attributes and people to achieve our goals. So we looked at my attributes relative to others to see what was missing, and we called that the Ray Gap. To be clear, we looked at the Ray Gap because I was the one leaving. Had Bob, David, or Greg been the ones stepping back, we would have been studying the gaps they left. Greg and David created a log of my various responsibilities and the differences between the qualities that they and I brought to handling them. Everyone agreed that the gap was in what we called shaping. To visualize what I mean by shaping and shapers, think of Steve Jobs, who was probably the greatest and most iconic shaper of our time, as measured by the size and successes of his shaping. A shaper is someone who comes up with unique and valuable visions and builds them out beautifully, typically over the doubts and oppositions of others. Jobs built the world's largest and most successful company by sequentially revolutionizing computing, music, communication, animation, and photography with beautifully designed products. Elon Musk of Tesla, SpaceX, and SolarCity, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Reed Hastings of Netflix are other great shapers from the business world. In philanthropy, Mohammed Yunus of Grameen, Jeffrey Canada of Harlem Children's Zone, and Wendy Kopp of Teach for America come to mind. And in government, Winston Churchill, Lee Kuan Yew, and Deng Xiaoping. Bill Gates has been a shaper in both business and philanthropy, as was Andrew Carnegie. Mike Bloomberg has been a shaper in business, philanthropy, and government. Einstein, Freud, Darwin, and Newton were giant shapers in the sciences. Christ, Mohammed, and Buddha were religious shapers. They all had original visions and successfully built them out. While these are some of the biggest shapers, I saw the shapers come in varying sizes. You probably know a few personally. They might be your local business, nonprofit, or community leaders, the people who drive change and build lasting organizations. My objective was to identify who the future shapers of Bridgewater would be, either by helping the people who were replacing me in the CEO job become them, or by finding shapers on the outside and bringing them in. On October 5th, 2011, a few months after I began to think about what makes a shaper, Steve Jobs died. That day, I wrote about him in our daily observations, one of the very few times I used the space to address non-investment-related content, because I admired him as a man who could visualize and execute in breathtakingly wonderful ways. Soon after, Walter Isaacson published his biography of Jobs. I noticed a number of similarities between us, especially when he quoted Jobs in his own words. Soon after that, an article titled, "Is Ray Dalio the Steve Jobs of Investing?" came out in a CIO magazine, which was a prominent investment industry publication. It also pointed out a number of similarities between us. That I, like Jobs, started my business from scratch, his from a garage, mine from a second bedroom in my apartment. That we both came up with innovative products that reshaped how our industries did things, and that we had unique management styles. Bridgewater had often been called the Apple of the investment world. But to be clear, I didn't think that Bridgewater or I held a candle to Apple and Jobs. Isaacson's book and the article pointed out other parallels in our backgrounds, goals, and approaches to shaping. For example, we were both rebellious, independent thinkers who worked relentlessly for innovation and excellence. We were both meditators who wanted to put a dent in the universe. We were both notoriously tough on our people. And of course, there were important differences too. I wished that Jobs had shared the principles he had used to achieve his goals. I wasn't just interested in Jobs and his principles. I wanted to know the qualities and the principles of all shapers so I could better understand the likenesses and the differences between them and form an archetype of the typical shaper. I had followed that approach for understanding everything. For example, I made an exhaustive study of recessions so that I could form a timeless picture of an archetypical recession and then understand the differences among them. I did that for all economic and market movements and was inclined to do it for just about everything because this approach helps me better understand how things work. So it made sense that I would do that to understand shapers too. I started by exploring the qualities of jobs and other shapers with Isaacson, at first in a private conversation in his office, and later in a public forum at Bridgewater. Since Isaacson had also written biographies of Albert Einstein and Ben Franklin, two other great shapers, I read them and probed him about them to try to glean what characteristics they had in common. Then I spoke with proven shapers I knew, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Reed Hastings, Muhammad Yunus, Jeffrey Canada, David Kelly of IDEO, and more. They had all visualized remarkable concepts and built organizations to actualize them, and done that repeatedly and over long periods of time. I asked them to take an hour's worth of personality assessments to discover their values, abilities, and approaches. While not perfect, these personality assessments have been invaluable. In fact, I've been adapting and refining them to help us in our recruiting and management. The answers these shapers provided to the standardized questions would give me objective and statistically measurable evidence about their similarities and their differences. It turns out that they have a lot in common. They are all independent thinkers who do not let anything or anyone stand in the way of achieving their audacious goals. They have very strong mental maps of how things should be done, and at the same time, a willingness to test those mental maps in the world of reality and change the way they do things to make them work better. They are extremely resilient because their need to achieve what they envision is stronger than the pain they experience as they struggle to achieve it. Perhaps most interesting, they have a wider range of vision than most people, either because they have that vision themselves or because they know how to get it from others who can see what they can't. All are able to see both big pictures and granular details and synthesize the perspectives they gain at those different levels, whereas most people just see it from one level or the other. They are simultaneously creative and systematic and practical. They are assertive and open-minded at the same time. Above all, they are passionate about what they are doing, intolerant of people who work for them who aren't excellent at what they do, and want to have a big beneficial impact on the world. Take Elon Musk. When he had just come out with the Tesla and showed me his own car for the first time, he had as much to say about the key fob that opened the doors as he did about his overarching vision for how Tesla fits into the broader future of transportation and how important it is to our planet. Later on, when I asked him how he came to start his company SpaceX, the audacity of his answer startled me. "For a long time," he answered, "I've thought that it's inevitable that something bad is going to happen on a planetary scale, a plague, a meteor, that will require humanity to start over somewhere else, like Mars." One day I went to the NASA website to see what progress they were making on their Mars program, and I realized they weren't even thinking about going there anytime soon. "I'd gotten $180 million when my partners and I sold PayPal," he continued. "And it occurred to me that if I spent $90 million and used it to acquire some ICBMs from the former USSR and then send one to Mars, I could encourage the exploration of Mars." When I asked him about his background in rocketry, he told me that he didn't have one. "I just started reading books," he said. That's how shapers think and act. At times, their extreme determination to achieve their goals can make them appear abrasive or inconsiderate, which was reflected in their test results. Nothing is ever good enough, and they experience the gap between what is and what could be as both a tragedy and a source of unending motivation. No one can stand in the way of their achieving what they're going after. On one of the personality assessments, there is a category that they almost all ranked low on, called concern for others. But that doesn't mean what it sounds like. Consider Muhammad Yunus, for example. He devoted his life to helping others. He received the Nobel Peace Prize for pioneering the ideas of microcredit and microfinance, and he won the Congressional Gold Medal, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and the Gandhi Peace Prize, and more. Yet, he tested low on concern for others. Jeffrey Canada, who has devoted most of his adult life to taking care of all the disadvantaged children in a 100-square-block area in New York's Harlem, also tested low on concern for others. Bill Gates, who is devoting most of his wealth and energy to saving and improving lives, tested low on it as well. Obviously, Yunus, Canada, and Gates care deeply about other people, yet the personality tests they took rated them low. Why was that? In speaking with them and reviewing the exact questions that led to these ratings, it became clear. When faced with a choice between achieving their goal or pleasing or not disappointing others, they would clearly choose achieving their goal every time. Through this investigative process, I learned that there are distinctly different types of shapers. The most important difference lies in whether their shaping comes in the form of inventing, managing, or both. For example, while Einstein shaped by inventing, he didn't have to manage. And while Jack Welch, who ran GE, and Lou Gerstner, who ran IBM, were great managers and leaders, they didn't have to be as inventive. The rarest cases were people like Jobs, Musk, Gates, Bezos, Page, Brin, and Dorsey, who were inventive visionaries, then built out and managed big organizations to achieve those visions. There are a lot of people who look like shapers in that they came up with a great idea and got it to the point where they could sell it for a lot of money, but did not shape consistently. Silicon Valley has many of these types. Perhaps they should be called inventors. I also saw that there were wonderful leaders of organizations who weren't classic shapers, in that they didn't come up with the original visions and build them out. Rather, they entered existing organizations and led them well. Only true shapers consistently move from one success to another and sustain success over decades, and those are the people I wanted to bring to Bridgewater. My examination of shapers and my reflections on my own qualities made clear to me that nobody sees the full range of what they need to see in order to be exceptionally successful, though some see a wider range than others. Those that do best see a wide range themselves and triangulate well with other brilliant people who see things in different and complementary ways. This realization has been important in making my transition out of management go well. While in the past I would encounter problems, figure out their causes, and design my own ways of getting around them, others who think differently than I do will make different diagnoses and designs. My job as mentor was to help them be successful at that. This exercise reminded me that there are far fewer types of people in the world than there are people, and far fewer different types of situations than there are situations. So matching the right types of people to the right types of situations is key. Because Gates and Jobs had recently left Microsoft and Apple, I watched their former organizations closely to help me better understand how I could help prepare Bridgewater to thrive without me. Certainly the most notable difference between them and Bridgewater was in our cultures. How we use the idea meritocracy of radical truth and radical transparency to bring problems and weaknesses to the surface to prompt forthright dealing with them. Systemizing our idea meritocracy. The more I did research on people, the clearer it became that there are different types of people, and that by and large, the same types of people in the same types of circumstances are going to produce the same types of results. Said differently, by knowing what someone is like, we can have a pretty good idea of what we can expect from them. So I was more motivated than ever to continue gathering lots of data on what people are like, to build pointillist pictures of them, to help us match people to responsibilities well. Doing that in an evidence-based way would enhance the idea meritocratic process of aligning people's responsibilities with their merits. While this all seemed so clear and commonsensical to me, it was much harder to achieve in practice. About a year into my transition, I saw that many new managers, and some older ones, still couldn't see the patterns of people's behaviors through time. In other words, they couldn't connect the dots between what people are like and the outcomes they produce. Their reluctance to probe people hard to get at what people are like was making things more difficult. But then I had a breakthrough, which grew out of an observation that the challenges we were having with making management decisions didn't exist in our investment decision making. I realized that by using big data analytics and other algorithms, our computers could connect those dots more efficiently than any of us could, just as they had helped us make those connections in the markets. These systems didn't have personal biases and emotional barriers to overcome. So those being analyzed couldn't be offended by the data-driven conclusions the computers were coming up with. In fact, they could look at the data and the algorithms, assess them for themselves, and suggest changes if they wanted. We were like scientists trying to develop tests and algorithms for analyzing ourselves objectively. On November 10th, 2012, I shared my thoughts with the management committee in an email. Its subject line was, "The Path Out, Systemizing Good Management." It read, "It is now clear to me that the main difference behind why the investment part of Bridgewater is likely to continue to do well, and most of the other parts of Bridgewater are unlikely to do as well, if we don't change the way we're operating, is that the decision-making processes for investment management have been so systemized that it's hard for people to screw them up because they are largely following the system's instructions, while the other areas of Bridgewater are much more dependent on the quality of the people and their decision-making." Think about that. Imagine how Bridgewater's investment decision-making would work if it operated the same as Bridgewater's management decision-making. In other words, it was much more dependent on the people we hired and how they collectively made decisions in their own ways. It would be a mess. The way the investment decision-making process works is that a small group of investment managers who created these systems see the system's conclusions and the reasoning of these systems while we make our own conclusions and explore the reasoning on our own. The machine does most of the work, and we interact with it in a quality way. And we are not dependent on much more faulty people. Think about how different management is. While we have principles, we don't have decision-making systems. In other words, I believe that the investment decision-making process is effective because the investment principles have been put into decision rules that make decisions that people then follow, while the management decision-making process is less effective because the management principles have not been put into decision rules that people can follow to make management decisions. It doesn't have to be that way. Having built the investment systems with the help of others, and knowing about both investment decision-making and management decision-making, I'm confident that it could be the same. The only questions are whether it can happen fast enough and what will happen in the meantime. The email went on to say, I'm working with Greg and others to develop these management systems in the same way I worked with Greg and others, Bob, for example, on the investment systems. You are seeing this happen via the development of baseball cards, dot collector, pain button, testing, job specking, and so on. Because I have a limited time to do this, we need to move fast. At the same time, we will have to fight the battles in the trenches with hand-to-hand combat to clean out those who are incapable and to bring in or promote those who are excellent. End of memo. One of the great things about algorithmic decision-making is that it focuses people on cause-effect relationships, and in that way helps foster a real idea meritocracy. When everyone can see the criteria the algorithms use and have a hand in developing them, they can all agree that the system is fair and trust the computer to look at the evidence, make the right assessments about people, and assign them the right authorities. The algorithms are essentially principles in action on a continuous basis. While our management system has a long way to go before it's as well automated as our investment system, the tools that it has made possible, especially the dot collector, which is an app that gathers information about what people are like in real time and is described later in work principles, these tools have made an incredible difference in the way we work. All these tools reinforce good habits and good thinking. The good habits come from thinking repeatedly in a principled way, like learning to speak a language. The good thinking comes from exploring the reasoning behind the principles. The ultimate goal of all of this was to help the people I cared about be more successful without me, which was becoming increasingly pressing as life's milestones continued to remind me of my stage in life. For example, I became a grandfather with the birth of Christopher Dalio on May 31, 2013. And in the summer of 2013, I had a serious health scare that turned out to be nothing but reminded me of my mortality. At the same time, I still loved playing the markets, which I plan to do until I die, making me even more eager to speed the transition from the second to the third phase of my life. Anticipating the European debt crisis. Beginning in 2010, my Bridgewater colleagues and I began to see the emergence of a debt crisis in Europe. We had looked at how much debt had to be sold and how much could be bought for a number of countries and determined that many southern European nations were likely to come up short. The resulting crisis could be as bad or worse than the one in 2008 and 9. As in 1980 and 2008, while our calculations clearly pointed to a debt crisis ahead, I knew that I could be wrong. Because it would be a big deal if I was right, I wanted to discuss what I was seeing with top policymakers, both to alert them and to have them correct me if they saw things differently. I encountered the same sort of resistance without good explanations that I encountered in Washington in 2008, only this time in Europe. Things were stable at the time, and though I knew there was no reason to believe that they would stay that way, most of the people I spoke to weren't ready to listen to my reasoning. I remember a meeting I had with the head of the International Monetary Fund when we were still in the calm before the storm. He doubted my seemingly crazy conclusions, and he wasn't interested in going through the numbers. Just as U.S. policymakers had before 2008, the Europeans did not fear what they hadn't experienced before. because things were good at the time, and the picture I was painting was worse than anything they'd experienced in their lifetimes, they found what I was saying implausible. They also didn't possess a granular understanding of who the borrowers and lenders were and how their abilities to borrow and lend would change with changing market conditions. Their understandings of how markets and economies work were oversimplified, like those of academics. For example, they looked at investors as a single thing they called the market, rather than an amalgam of different players who bought and sold for different reasons. When the markets did badly, they wanted to do things that increased confidence, figuring that if they built confidence, the money would come and the problems would disappear. They didn't see that whether they were confident or not, specific buyers didn't have enough money and credit to buy all the debt that had to be sold. Just as human bodies work in essentially the same way, so do the economic machines in different countries. And just as physical diseases infect people without regard to nationality, so do the economic diseases. So while the policymakers were at first skeptical, I approached my conversations with them by looking at the physiology of the case at hand. I would diagnose the economic disease they were suffering from and show them how its symptoms progress by referencing prior analogous cases. Then I'd explain the best practices for treating the disease at different stages. We would have high-quality backs and forths about the linkages and the evidence. Yet when I did succeed in helping them see the linkages, the political decision-making systems that they had to work within were dysfunctional. Not only did they have to decide what they would do as individual countries, the 19 countries of the European Union had to agree with each other before they could act, in most cases unanimously. There was often no way of resolving disagreements, which was a big problem because what needed to be done, for example, printing money, was objectionable to German economic conservatives. As a result, crises would intensify to breaking points while European leaders grappled in long closed-door meetings. Those power struggles tested the nerves of everyone involved. I can't possibly convey the amount of bad behavior these policymakers had to endure for the benefit of the people they represented. For example, in January 2011, a few weeks after he'd been appointed Minister of the Economy and Competitiveness by Spain's new president, I met Luis de Guindos, a man I learned to admire for his forthrightness, intelligence, and heroic willingness to sacrifice himself for his country's well-being. The old government in Spain had been thrown out, and the new government took office as Spanish banks were about to collapse. The new Spanish policymakers were immediately forced to haggle with representatives from the IMF, the European Union, and the European Central Bank, in other words, the group they called the Troika. They did this into the wee hours of the morning, and at the end were required to sign a loan agreement that essentially handed over control of their banking system to the Troika in exchange for financial support they desperately needed. My meeting with Minister de Guindos took place in the morning after the first and most difficult of these negotiations. With bloodshot eyes, but a very alert mind, he patiently and forthrightly answered all of my difficult questions and shared his thoughts about what reforms Spain should undertake to deal with its difficult problems. During the next couple of years, over considerable objections, he and his government pushed these controversial reforms through. He never got the praise he deserved, but he didn't care because his satisfaction came from seeing the results he produced. To me, that is a hero. As time passed, the European debtor countries fell into deeper depressions. This led Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, to make bold decisions to buy bonds in September 2012. This move averted the imminent debt crisis, saved the euro, and, as it would turn out, made a lot of money for the ECB. But it failed to immediately stimulate credit and economic growth in the countries that were in depression. Inflation, which the ECB was mandated to get to about 2%, was below that target and falling. While the ECB had offered loans on attractive terms to banks in an attempt to solve the issue, banks weren't taking them up on the offer sufficiently to make a difference. I believed that things would continue to worsen unless the ECB printed money and pushed it into the system by buying more bonds. The move toward quantitative easing appeared obvious and necessary, so I visited Draghi and the ECB's executive board to share my concerns. At the meeting, I told them why this approach would not be inflationary, because it is the level of spending, which is money plus credit, and not just the amount of money that drives spending and inflation. I focused on how the economic machine works because I felt that if we could agree on that, most importantly, how bond buying moves money through the system, we could agree on the impacts on inflation and economic growth. In that meeting, and in all such meetings, I shared our calculations as well as the important cause-effect relationships as I saw them, so that together we could assess whether the conclusions made sense. A major impediment to this action was that there was no single bond market for the entire eurozone, and the ECB, like most other central banks, isn't supposed to favor one area or country over another. Given those conditions, I shared my theory of how the ECB could do quantitative easing without breaking its rules by buying bonds proportionately across every member country, even though Germany didn't need or want the easing that such purchases would bring them. At the time, the German economy was doing relatively well, and inflation fears were beginning to emerge. In the course of those 18 months, I met with several top European economic policymakers, perhaps most importantly, German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble, who I judged to be exceptionally thoughtful and selfless. I also saw how politics within Germany and Europe worked. When push came to shove, the ECB would have to do what was best for Europe, which was to print the money and buy the bonds in the way I suggested. Doing that was consistent with the ECB's mandate, and the European debtor countries had the votes to allow it to do that. So I figured that it would be the Germans who would get overruled and face the decision to leave the eurozone, which they would ultimately not do because their leaders had strong commitments to the eurozone with Germany as part of it. Draghi finally announced the move in January 2015. It had a great effect and created a precedent that would allow more quantitative easing in the future if they were needed. The market reaction was very positive. On the day of Draghi's announcement, European equities were up 1.5%, government bond yields fell across the major European economies, and the euro fell 2% against the dollar, which helped to stimulate the economy. These moves continued over the following months, stimulating European economies, supporting a pickup in growth, and reversing the decline in inflation. The ECB's decision was obviously the right thing to do for reasons that were relatively simple. But seeing how controversial its move was, it occurred to me that the world needed a simple explanation of how the economic machine works, because if everyone understood the basics, then economic policymakers would be able to do the right things a lot faster and with less angst in the future. That led me to make a 30-minute video, How the Economic Machine Works, which I released in 2013. Besides explaining how the economy works, It provides a template that helps people assess their economies and gives them guidance about what to do and what to expect during a crisis. It had a much bigger impact than I expected, as it was watched by more than 5 million people in 8 languages. A number of policymakers told me in private that they found it helpful for their own understanding, for dealing with their constituents, and for finding better paths forward. This was very rewarding to me. From my contacts with policymakers in a number of countries, I learned quite a bit about how international relations really works. It's quite different from what most people imagine. Countries behave in a more self-interested and less considerate way than what most of us would consider appropriate for individuals. When countries negotiate with one another, they typically operate as though they are opponents in a chess match or merchants in a bazaar in which maximizing one's own benefit is the sole objective. Smart leaders know their own country's vulnerabilities, take advantage of others' vulnerabilities, and expect other countries' leaders to do the same. Most people who haven't had direct contact with the leadership of their own and other countries form their views based on what they learn in the media and become quite naive and inappropriately opinionated as a result. That's because dramatic stories and gossip draw more readers and viewers than does clinical objectivity. Also, in some cases, journalists have their own ideological biases that they're trying to advance. As a result, most people who see the world through the lens of the media tend to look for who is good and who is evil, rather than what the vested interests and relative powers are and how they are being played out. For example, people tend to embrace stories about how their own country is moral and the rival country is not, when most of the time these countries have different interests that they are trying to maximize. The best behaviors one can hope for come from leaders who can weigh the benefits of cooperation and who have long enough time frames that they can see how the gifts they give this year may bring them benefits in the future. These conflicts of vested interests don't just play out internationally. They can also be nasty within countries. Finding out what's true and trying to do what's in the collective best interest is rare, though most policymakers pretend that that's what they're really doing. More typically, they act in support of their constituents' interests. For example, representatives of those with greater income will say higher taxes stifle growth, while representatives of those with less income will say the opposite. It's hard to get everyone to even try to look at the whole picture objectively, let alone to operate in the interests of the whole. Nonetheless, I came to respect most of the policymakers I worked with and feel sorry for them because of the terrible positions they're in. Most are highly principled people who are forced to operate in unprincipled environments. The job of a policymaker is challenging under the best circumstances, and it's almost impossible during a crisis. The politics are horrendous, and distortions and outright misinformation from the media makes things worse. A number of the policymakers I've met, including Draghi, De Guindos, Schäuble, Bernanke, Geithner, Summers, and many others, were real heroes, meaning that they put others and the mission they committed to above themselves. Unfortunately, most policymakers enter their careers as idealists and leave disillusioned. One of those heroes I've been fortunate enough to learn from, and I hope help, is China's Wang Qishan, who has been a remarkable force for good for decades. To explain what he's like, and the journey that took him to the top of China's leadership would take more of this book than I can spare. In brief, Wang is a historian, a very high-level thinker, and a very practical man. I have rarely known a person to be both extremely wise and extremely practical. A leading shaper of the Chinese economy for decades, who is also responsible for eliminating corruption, he is known to be a no-nonsense man who can be trusted to get stuff done. Every time I go to China, we meet for 60 to 90 minutes. We talk about what's happening in the world and how that relates to thousands of years of history and the never-changing nature of mankind. We discuss a wide range of other topics as well, ranging from physics to artificial intelligence. We are both keenly interested in how most everything happens over and over again, the forces behind those patterns, and the principles that work and don't work in dealing with them. I gave Wang a copy of Joseph Campbell's great book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, because he is a classic hero and I thought it might help him. I also gave him The Lessons of History, a 104-page distillation of the major forces through history by Will and Ariel Durant, and River Out of Eden by the insightful Richard Dawkins, which explains how evolution works. He gave me Gorgy Plekhanov's classic On the Role of the Individual in History. All of these books showed how the same things happened over and over again throughout history. Most of my conversations with Wang are at the principle level. He sees the rhyme of history and puts the particulars we speak of in the context of, quote, unattainable goals appeal to heroes, end quote, he once told me. Quote, capable people are those who sit there worrying about the future. The unwise are those who worry about nothing. If conflicts got resolved before they became acute, there wouldn't be any heroes, unquote. His advice has helped me in planning Bridgewater's future. For example, when I asked him about the checks and balances of power, he pointed to Julius Caesar's overthrow of the Roman Senate and Republic as an illustration of how important it is to make sure that no one person is more powerful than the system. I took his advice to heart as I set out to improve Bridgewater's governance model. Every time I speak with Wang, I feel like I get closer to cracking the unified code that unlocks the laws of the universe. He uses his timeless perspective to see the present and the likely future more clearly. Being around such people, especially if I can help them, is thrilling to me.
Returning the Boon.
Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, one of the books I gave to Wang as well as a number of other heroes I know, was introduced to me by my son Paul in 2014. While I had seen Campbell on television nearly 30 years earlier and remembered being impressed by him, I hadn't read his book. In it, Campbell looks at a large number of heroes from different cultures, some real and some mythical, and describes their archetypal journeys through life. Campbell's description of how heroes become heroes align with my thinking about shapers. It gave me powerful insight about the heroes I know and the patterns of my own life. For Campbell, a hero isn't a perfect person who always gets things right. Far from it. A hero is someone who, quote, found or achieved or did something beyond the normal range of achievement, and who has given his life to something bigger than himself or other than himself, end quote. I had met a number of such people throughout my life. What is most interesting about Campbell's work was his description of how they got that way. Heroes didn't begin as heroes. They became them because of the way one thing leads to another. They typically start out leading ordinary lives in an ordinary world and are drawn by a call to adventure. This leads them down a road of trials filled with battles, temptations, successes, and failures. Along the way, they are helped by others, often those who are further along the journey and serve as mentors, though those who are less far along also help in various ways. They also gain allies and enemies and learn how to fight, often against convention. Along the way, they encounter temptations and have clashes and reconciliations with their fathers and their sons. They overcome their fear of fighting because of their great determination to achieve what they want, and they gain their special powers, in other words, their skills, from both battles that test them and teach them, and from gifts, such as advice, that they receive from others. Over time, they both succeed and fail, but increasingly succeed more than they fail, as they grow stronger and keep striving for more, which leads to ever bigger and more challenging battles. Heroes inevitably experience at least one very big failure, which Campbell calls an abyss or a belly of the whale experience, that tests whether they have the resilience to come back and fight smarter with more determination. If they do, they undergo a change, a metamorphosis, as he calls it, in which they experience the fear that protects them without losing the aggressiveness that propels them forward. With triumphs come rewards. Though they don't realize it when they are in their battles, the hero's biggest reward is what Campbell calls the boon, which is the special knowledge of how to succeed that the hero has earned through his journey. Late in life, winning more battles and acquiring more rewards typically becomes less exciting to heroes than passing along that knowledge to others, returning the boon, as Campbell called it. Once the boon is returned, the hero is free to live and then free to die, or the way that I see it, free to transition from the second phase in life to the third phase in life, in which one is free to savor life until one passes away. Reading Campbell, I saw that heroes, like shapers, come in varying sizes. There are big ones and small ones, that they are real people, and that we all know some. I also saw that being a hero is typically not all that it's cracked up to be. They get beat up a lot, and many get attacked, humiliated, or killed even after they triumph. In fact, it's hard to see the logic for choosing this hero role if one were to choose. But I could see and relate to how a certain type of person would start and stay on that path. Learning about the hero's journeys helped me crystallize my understanding of where I was in my own journey and what I wanted to do next. The section on returning the boon spoke to me in a personal way, as though Campbell knew exactly what I was wrestling with. With the reflections it prompted, I could see that my life would be over in a relatively short time, and that what I'd leave behind could be more important, last longer, and affect many more people than just those at Bridgewater and my family. That helped make clear that I needed to pass along the things that I had that could help others beyond me, most importantly, the principles in this book, but also my money. As the saying goes, you can't take it with you. My need to start thinking about who should get what wasn't just because of my age and the time it would take to do it well. It was also instinctive. Over time, the circle of people I cared about had broadened from just me when I was young, to me and my family when I became a parent, to my community when I was a bit more mature, to people beyond my community and the whole environment now. Wrestling with the questions of philanthropy. My first exposure to philanthropy occurred in the late 1990s, when I was approaching 50. At the time, Matt was 16, spoke Mandarin, and visited a Chinese orphanage to help someone, where he learned that a $500 surgery could save or radically improve some lives. We and our friends gave him money to help. Then my friend, Paul Tudor Jones, taught Matt how to create a 501c3 foundation, and Matt, just a junior in high school, created the ChinaCare Foundation in 2000.
Matt brought our family to the orphanages, so we had close contact with these special needs children and fell in love with them. We also watched Matt struggle to decide which children would live and which would die because there wasn't enough money to save them all. Imagine being faced with the choice between a big night out on the town or saving a child's life. That was essentially the choice we were constantly faced with. This experience led us to become more involved with philanthropy. So in 2003, we set up our own foundation to provide support in more organized ways. We wanted to do our philanthropy together as a family activity, which has proven to be fabulous. Figuring out the best way to give away money is as complex an undertaking as figuring out how to make it. Though we now know a lot more about it than we did when we started, we still don't always feel capable to make the best decisions possible, so my family and I are still feeling our way through it. I will give you a few examples of the questions we've been wrestling with and how our thinking has evolved, starting with the question of how much money should be saved for the family relative to how much should go to people and causes that are more distant yet more desperate in need. Long before I had a lot of money, I had determined that I wanted my sons to have only enough to afford excellent health care, excellent education, and an initial boost to help them get their career started. My perspective was influenced by my own journey through life, which took me from having nothing to having a lot. That taught me to struggle well and made me strong. I wanted the same for the people I loved. So, when I had earned a lot of money, I felt that I had plenty of money to give away to others. Over time, we gained experience in trying to help in a number of areas. I learned how fast money goes and that we didn't have nearly enough to take care of everything we cared about. Additionally, when my first grandchild was born, it prompted me to wonder how many generations should I budget to protect? Speaking to others in comparable positions, I discovered that even the richest people feel short of the money that they need in order to accomplish what they want to do. So I studied how other families approach the question of how much to set aside for family and how much to give away at what pace. While our family still has not answered these questions definitively, I figured that an amount significantly more than half to help others would be about right. Which causes to donate to was another big question. Barbara's biggest passion has been helping students in the most stressed public school districts in Connecticut, especially those students who were called disengaged and disconnected. A study she funded showed that 22% of high school students fall into one of these two categories, which was shocking because most will probably become adults who will suffer and be burdens on society rather than flourishing contributors to it. Because she has a lot of direct contact with these children and their teachers, she understands their needs. When she learned that 10,000 of them didn't have adequate winter coats, she felt compelled to provide them. What she showed me opened my eyes. How can clothing and nutrition be so severely deficient in this land of opportunity? Everyone in our family believes that equal opportunity, which is one of the most fundamental human rights, requires equal educational opportunity, and that educational opportunities are terribly unequal. The economic costs in the forms of crime and incarceration, as well as social costs of not investing in improving these conditions, are immense. While we've felt compelled to help, we've discovered it is very difficult to have a significant impact relative to the size of the problem. I feel deeply connected to nature, especially the oceans. The oceans are our world's greatest asset, covering 72% of its surface and comprising 99% of its habitable space. It thrills me to support scientists who are exploring the oceans and media that shows them in these incredible environments. I'm on a mission to make clear that ocean exploration is even more important and exciting than space exploration, so that our oceans get more support and will be more sensibly managed. To add to my excitement, my son Mark is a wildlife filmmaker who shares my passion, so we get to pursue it together. Matt's passion is to bring inexpensive, effective computing to the developing world as a way of expanding and improving education and healthcare. Paul's passion is mental health, and his wife's is fighting climate change. Devin is more focused on his career than philanthropy now, but his wife cares deeply about animal welfare. Our family continues to support special needs children in China, as well as an institute that teaches best practices to Chinese philanthropists. We also support the teaching of meditation to children in stressful environments and to veterans with PTSD. We support cutting-edge heart research, microfinance, and other social enterprises, and many other things. As I said, it's pretty eclectic. We view our donations as investments and want to make sure that we have high philanthropic returns on our money. So another big question we wrestle with is how to measure those returns. It's much easier to measure efficiency in a business by seeing how much its revenue exceeds its costs. Because of this, we developed an attraction to sustainable social enterprise. Still, I saw that so many philanthropic investments could pay off economically as well as socially, and it tormented me that our society passes them up. We also wrestled with how big our organization should be and what governance controls we should have in order to ensure the quality of our philanthropic decision-making. I approach these decisions in the same way I explain in Work Principles later in this audio recording, by creating formalized principles and policies for our decision-making. For example, because we are bombarded with requests for grants that we can't intelligently look at, I mandated a policy to not review unsolicited requests so that our staff has the time to sort through the areas we wanted to be focused on. We are continuously improving our principles and policies, and I even dream about building out decision-making algorithms for our philanthropic efforts, but that's way beyond my reach now. As you might have guessed, we also seek advice from the most experienced and respected people possible. Bill Gates and the people we met through our participation in his, Melinda Gates, and Warren Buffett's giving pledge have been enlightening. Others, such as Mohammed Yunus, Paul Jones, Jeff Skoll, the Amityar folks, and the people at TED have been very helpful. The most important thing we learned is that there's no one right way to do philanthropy, though there are plenty of wrong ways. Giving away the money that I acquired during my lifetime and doing that well has been a joy, a challenge, and the appropriate thing to do at this stage in my life. Bridgewater turns 40. In June 2015, Bridgewater marked its 40th anniversary, an amazing milestone we celebrated by throwing a hell of a party. We had a lot to celebrate, since by most measures, no firm in our industry had been as successful. Key people who had been a part of our journey from the outset and throughout our 40 years got up to speak. Each of them described the evolution of the company through their eyes, how some things changed over the years while others stayed the same, most importantly, our culture of striving for excellence in work and excellence in relationships by being radically truthful and radically transparent with each other. They recounted how we uniquely and repeatedly tried new things, failed, learned from our failures, improved, and tried again, doing that over and over in an upward spiral. When it was my turn to speak, I wanted to convey what I had always tried to give the people at Bridgewater and what I wanted them to have in the future without me. I explained. It is a community in which you always have the right and obligation to make sense of things and a process for working yourselves through your disagreements. A real functioning idea meritocracy. I want you to think, not follow, while recognizing that you can be wrong and that you have weaknesses. I want to give you radical open-mindedness and an idea meritocracy that will take you from being trapped in your own heads to having access to the best minds in the world to help you make the best decisions for you and for our community. I want to help you all struggle well and evolve to get the most out of life. Though after that 40th celebration, there were still important things that had to be done, at the same time, I thought we were wrapping up my transition nicely. I had no idea how difficult the next year would be.